Hey everyone, I'm Adrian Wojnarowski, host of the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by digital media. For the past 50 plus years, Donnie Walsh has been one of the most influential figures on the basketball landscape, first as a player and coach in the Atlantic Coast Conference under Dean Smith and Frank McGuire, as an assistant coach in the old ABA, and finally across a quarter of a century as the successful general manager of the Indiana Pacers and later his hometown New York Knicks. Walsh drafted and molded the core of two decades of great success with the Pacers, 19 trips to the postseason, 6 appearances in the Eastern Conference Finals, and a berth in the NBA Finals. He helped to clean up a toxic mess as GM of the New York Knicks. And now, at 75 years old, Donnie Walsh still goes into the Pacers offices most days to work with President Larry Bird and GM Kevin Pritchard as a consultant with Indiana. Walsh has long been the consummate Renaissance man in NBA front office circles, a man who possesses a law degree and almost took a job that would have altered his life and the modern basketball landscape forever. He nearly went to work for President Nixon's law firm in New York.
Everybody my age is sitting at a desk with books piled up to the ceiling. And I just, by the time I got to the elevator, I went, oh, I can't do this.
Walsh changed everything for the Pacers when he selected Reggie Miller in the 1987 NBA draft, a Hall of Famer who would play his entire 19-year career in Indianapolis. Still, there were times Walsh feared he might lose Miller in free agency.
I did worry about L.A. in the beginning, and then I wasn't sure about them. But New York became, because he had done what he did to them, and they had a lot of cap money one summer, and I thought, oh, this is going to be it. And somehow we got through that.
And then, after retiring in Indiana, the chance to resurrect his hometown Knicks was too intriguing to pass up. Only New York ownership made it harder than it needed to be at several turns, including trying to get Walsh to hire back Isaiah Thomas as the franchise's general manager. Walsh told owner Jim Dolan, I'll resign before I do that, and here's why.
I feel bad. I still feel bad because I liked Isaiah. But I really felt like if you do this, this is going to be a circus, really.
Terrific visit with Donnie Walsh here. I think you'll enjoy it as much as I did. Let's get to Donnie. Donnie, welcome in here. Great to see you again. I want to start with this, Donnie. Across this long span you've had around basketball and in the NBA, starting later in your career, could you ever have imagined how big all of this would get?
Yeah, to a degree, I do. Now, I came from college basketball. Right. I started in 1965, and I left that, I think, in 1976, and went with Denver, Larry Brown, right. And I was a coach. And pretty much by the time I got to being a coach in the NBA, I had always wanted to be a general manager. For about the last 2 or 3 years, I knew I wasn't going to be a good coach. So I basically told them there and didn't realize, you know, how hard it would be to be a general manager. But that was my whole thing. And when I left Denver, I was out for a year. And then George Irvin called me up and had me come down here to be an assistant coach. The owners here had met me during that time and said they wanted to talk to me about being the general manager. And to make a long story short, they hired me. So it was like, wow, you know. And so I've been here since then, which was, I think, 84.
84 as a coach, and 87, you were named GM.
86, general manager.
86, 87
right.
Season,
that's
right.
That's right.
Yeah. Your day-to-day duties now, you wake up in the morning on a Monday to a Friday in Indiana. You go in the office?
Yeah,
so
I do. I come to the office every day. But between me, the owner, and also just out of pure respect, when I came back when Larry left for a year, and so I was here for a year, but the idea was Larry was going to come back, and so I wanted him to come back. And, you know, when he did come back, I was going to leave, and the owner said, well, I'd like to keep you here. And I said, okay, I'll do that, but I'm not going to be involved in the day-to-day operation of the team. And he said, why not? I said, well, I'll be here every day. But I said, you know, I think you got a president of basketball operations, you got a general manager, And I said, I know from having that position, you don't need a guy standing behind you all the time saying, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? I said, so just let them, you know, if they want me to be involved in something, they'll ask me to be involved. Meantime, I'll be here, go to practice, and I'll be available for anything they want me to do. And so that's generally the way it's gone. And that's totally out of respect. I knew when I hired Larry as a coach and as a general manager that he would be, I thought he'd be a great coach, and he was. And then I thought he'd be a great general manager, and I think he's on his way. So I have total faith in those guys. And all I want to do is I'm here. I've done it a long time. So sometimes, you know, when you're in the midst of something, I could help with the way you view the cap, which I did the first year. You know, there's two ways when you have a situation in free agency. You can go in and say, well, what we're going to have to do is use over-the-cap money. And the way you do that can change, and it can be more beneficial to you to do one way instead of the other. So I did that kind of thing for a while. But now Peter knows all that, Peter Dinwiddie. So I don't have as much chance to do that.
Donnie, what's unique, too, about Indiana is there's been a lot of ownership turnover in the last 10 years, 5 years, 12, you know, and it's a new kind of owner, much more hands-on. They've made their money in whether it's tech industries or places where they've been involved in the product. Herb Simon is a throwback to another time the NBA. Ownership was different. I imagine you look around the league and say, well, we have in Indiana, I don't want to say it's mom and pop. It's not. You have a big payroll and you've got a great fan base here. But there's a mom and pop quality. It's not so corporate as it might be in a lot of other places.
Well, that's because of, well, Mel and Herb at one time, but now Herb. I mean, Herb has always dealt with it the same way. He basically is really interested, and if you think he's not, you don't know him. But he's not interfering. He's in their business. They have like 2,500 malls, let's say. They don't go down and tell them how to run the malls. Let me give them a general idea of what they want. Then they give them certain things they want. And they show up every now and then, but it's more supportive than it is critiquing. I'm sure they do critique if the thing's not doing well. But that's kind of the way they do with the Pacers. You know, they put you in charge. They say, okay, we want to run a first-class operation. You know, we're a small market team, so we can't go as first-class as some places. But to tell you the truth, over the years, they have. You know, they're building a practice site now. We built a new arena. You know, it's really worked out well here because of who they are, really. And I told Kevin when I first came.
Kevin Pritchard, your
GM. Kevin Pritchard. You can't find a better owner than Herb. I'm telling you that right now. Because he hadn't really known him. He was working as a scout. And then he was just getting the general manager job. And so I said, look, I'm telling you right now, there's no way to have a better owner than Herb. Doesn't mean he's not interested. Doesn't mean he doesn't get mad if you do the wrong thing. But he's got a heart. He's got a, you know, he believes in the Pacers. He wants to stand for certain things. And if you do those things, you won't hear from him.
And what I've always admired about the organization, and I think it matters to your fan base and it creates a continuity, I don't want to say they don't bring people in from the outside, because you have, but, you know, your GM for really 20 years, 19, 20 years in that window, and Larry comes in, has a connection to the state. Now, he didn't play for the Pacers, but he's synonymous with the state. And when there's decisions here, the idea of having somebody who has Pacer roots, you go around your organization and the people who work there, you know, Mel Daniels, who passed away recently, was a part of the organization. You walk in the building and you get that handshake from Mel and you know you're in Indiana.
Yeah.
It seems like that matters to Herb, and it's mattered to, you know, I think a fan base as loyal as this one appreciates having connections.
Oh, yeah. And I felt that back when I was coaching here. That I could see that there was a special feeling about the championship teams that they had here in the ABA. And at that time in the NBA, they didn't want to mention the ABA. They didn't want to have any reference to red, white, and blue balls. And so many places it wasn't. But when I became their general manager, I saw great value in that. That they, first of all, that was our tradition, you know, because we hadn't done well in the NBA up to that point. So I really tried to, you know, go back and honor those guys and put their numbers up in the ceiling. And I think it made us a better franchise. And I think that holds true. We've got guys in the franchise who played, like Mel did, Darnell Hillman, Billy Keller for a while was a shooting coach. So there is a feeling that if a guy can do something and he used to play here, you ought to at least bring him in and see if he can do it.
And the value to that, the best player in your history, Reggie Miller, played his whole career here. And I remember once talking to you, it was near the end of Reggie's career, and I think I asked you, I think they were playing the Knicks in a playoff series. You were. And you said the one place you ever worried about was New York. There was a couple free agent windows where the Knicks worry me. And as a GM, you're always thinking of the possibilities. The fact that Reggie never left, I think, and played his whole career here. And then when he had a chance to come back, there was almost that time he came back with the Celtics when they tried to get him to come out of retirement. And I think for him, the idea of wearing another uniform, I think it bothered him. I think he said, I don't want to come back and play a few weeks or a few months for another team. But I always thought that had value. It gave a validation to your organization.
I did too. And I was appreciative that Reggie took that attitude, obviously, because he could have gone other places. And almost the whole time he didn't do that. You know, his agent was on Tellum, and by that time I'd gotten to know on very well. And then, you know, in the course of negotiation, he might throw it out there just to make me worry about it, which I did. But pretty much I always had confidence that Reggie wasn't going to go and chase the championship with like a super team or something like that. And that he saw the value of being in one place where you become the face of the franchise and it can last for longer than just your career. Now, Reggie's gone on to another career in which he's very good at. So, you know, I don't know that that's helping him now, but everyone remembers those games in the Garden. I mean, everybody does.
And the thing, too, if you look at Reggie's personality from the outside, somebody might say, hey, Reggie's going to want Broadway. He's going to want the Garden. Or he's a Southern California kid. He's going to want to go play for the Lakers. He's going to want that stage. And I wonder, in this day and time in the NBA, if Reggie came along now with the culture of the league of players teaming up, I wonder, could you sell 17 years to Reggie Miller again in this day and age?
You know, I think about that a lot because we did have Reggie for 19 years.
19, yeah.
And, you know, I see what the way the league is right now. And look, it's a business. So I respect that for the players. And they got a, you know, they got a short lifespan, as they say. And it's, by the way, getting longer. But their approach to it has got to be coming from them. And so I never take umbrage at that. But it makes me feel fortunate that I had a Reggie that whole time that I didn't, you know, didn't really worry about losing because I knew his attitude. He really wanted to stay here. He had made his career here up to that point. And Reggie wasn't a guy that wanted to join two great players that were going to win a championship and be the third guy that won the championship. He just didn't want to do that.
You know, and going through Michael Jordan, you guys got to the conference final six times. You were in the playoffs every year you were as GM. You didn't miss the playoffs.
Maybe once.
I think you might have missed it once. And then you came back in the year you took over for Larry, a team Larry had put together, but you got to the conference final.
No, he did.
Again, but the competitive nature of that era and the series that you had with New York, the series you had with Chicago, the only memory you have of it is Reggie driving Michael so crazy. He's got him around the throat.
Right.
Like that's the picture you have of them. And it spoke to, it's not that guys aren't competitive now.
Right.
They're competitive, but you just wouldn't have imagined. You just wouldn't, like you couldn't go to bed at night and go, he's not going to the Bulls. Maybe he leaves, but I can't imagine he's like suiting up coming back in our building with the Bulls.
Right.
That was inconceivable.
Right. I wouldn't have thought that ever. I did worry about L.A. in the beginning, and then I wasn't sure about them. But New York became, because he had done what he did to them, and they had a lot of cap money one summer, and I thought, oh, this is going to be it. And somehow we got through that. But that's a whole funny story in its own.
With those negotiations that summer, was there, you said, like, it was Arne Tellem's, it's the agent's job to,
but
right? There's
got to
be some fear that he might leave to get what you want. That's leverage, right?
Yeah, well, here's exactly what happened, I'll tell you. I was in Indiana at home, I mean, and I get a phone call. Arne is on his way to meet me to negotiate for Reggie. Now, I'm worried about New York, but I get a phone call. Donnie, the Knicks just signed Allen Houston and Chris
Childs?
Childs.
Yep.
So I clicked off their cap in my mind. I went, and that's definitely true? Yeah, they're on their way to New York now to sign the contract. So now about 2 hours later, Arn comes in. And he's got his bag, and you can see him. He's like, you know, he's had a hard trip. He comes in, and he goes like, how you doing, Donnie? And I said, I'm doing good, Arn. How you doing? He said, anything going on in the league? And I said, not much, just Alan Houston and Chris Childs just signed with New York. He threw the bag down. He said, you've got to give me the money. You've got to. And so, you know, I said, we're going to give you a good deal. And so we worked it out. But it was the funniest thing I ever saw because he didn't even pretend.
Right. Arn has walked into a lot of rooms with a lot of leverage and used it, right?
And in that one, he thought he had it walking in, and within 2 minutes, he didn't have it. You know? Arn was trying to get Reggie more money. It wasn't really when I look back on it, at the time, I was worried about it. But when I look back on it, I don't think Reggie would have left. I think, you know, if we lowballed him, he might have. But I really think he was just going to try to get me up and up because he could go to New York. And that's what I thought. And then when that happened, I knew that's over.
Being a GM, even at that time in the 90s, even which isn't that long ago, the relationships were different. It seems like relationships, the league has become very transactional. And I don't know if, you know, you watch Larry do the job and Kevin Pritchard day in and day out. I don't know that they have the relationships all around the league that your generation had in the league. Do you agree with that? And
I don't know.
Would it be less fun if you were starting out in it now? Would you have less fun than you had in your era?
Probably, yeah, because back then, you know, you were dealing with people on the phone. We had different functions, scouting deals, but they were like in Chicago, Portsmouth. And in the league meetings, there was league meetings at the All-Star game that all the GMs went to. Now they have them, but they send like the assistant GM. So you don't have the people coming in one place at one time that you had back then. And, you know, over the years we got to know each other. So when you went to those meetings, they were really positioned at the right time to be talking trades and everything else. And so you would do that, but you do it face to face, not on the phone. And I don't see that happening as much anymore. And you got to know the other GM. The one thing I knew was that there were no stupid guys back then. You know, anytime you got it in your head, you were going to outsmart some. And I tell guys that now, don't think you're going to outsmart any of these guys. They're all smart when it comes to the game of basketball. They are smart people. And that was confirmed to me when I would meet with them, you know. So you didn't get into the, like, games that you can play if you don't know a guy and you're trying to figure out. There was more like you knew him, you know. And so, you know, well, in dealing with this guy, either give him what he wants or the game, it's over. We're not going to have a trade. You know, this guy will probably negotiate a little more. You could look at his team and figure out, well, okay, you know, there's a real deal to be made here. It was a little easier back then.
Team building, you built that core right through the draft, right in a row. Chuck,
right.
Reggie, Rick Smits, and Dale Davis. And it gave you your core group to start. And they hadn't won here. And you mentioned, like, you sort of, let's embrace that ABA pass because we had success, right? Are the basics of team building still unchanged? In a market like Indiana, where you're not just going to go out and put a big three together like Miami did, like, it's still got to be done largely through the draft?
I think it's a combination. You've got to have good drafts because that will give you 3 or 4 years of a player at a reasonable salary before you have to up it. And you're going to have to up it, particularly if you're successful.
Right.
You know, that's the one thing that once I got into a certain point where we were going to Eastern Conference Finals, when my free agents came up, they were no longer willing to take what would work in Indiana. They were, wait a minute, we just beat, you know, so-and-so to get here. And so you'd have to pay top dollar for those years. Today, it isn't so much the money. It is the money because the money's going way up. But what's different is that the style has changed so much that, you know, you're not looking for the big guys, the big power forward and all that. You're looking for good basketball players. And I think you can have a little more room to look out there and see guys who can fit and play for you. You know, you have to have athleticism. You have to have guys that know how to play if you're going to play small ball, let's say. But, you know, it's not as easy as plugging in a the guy at power forward, the guy here, a guy there. You've got to really look for quality and talent now, I think. And if you then need to go to a more role team, then you get in the free agency market and try to pick the right guy for your team.
Your background in law, Donnie, going to law school and thinking I'm probably going to go into the business. I don't know that you had an idea that you were going to go coach necessarily. You had an offer from Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
Did you meet with Nixon? Did you go to New York and meet with Nixon?
I went up and met the entire partnership, and he was the last one I met. And I didn't know I was going to meet him, but they were moving me from one room to the other. The one thing I noticed was, and this probably changed my ideas, but the one thing I noticed was that all the guys I were meeting were all partners, and you know, it was like Mitchell and all those kind of guys were around the room.
It was a whole Watergate crew, right? They went from there.
I don't want to say that.
Okay.
No, they were successful men.
Right.
But, and I didn't know that.
It wasn't. But it became a lot of his. There were.
Yeah,
guys.
When I look back on it, some of the people that I met were that were in Watergate, or so to speak. But anyway, I went around and met all these guys, and the last one was Vice President then, Nixon, who had run for president, but he hadn't been elected president yet. Mm. And it was, you know, it was very exciting to meet the guy. So I was like, you know, kind of like this and that with it. Like, how do I think I'm going to like this? Because I had already taken the job. So to leave the place, they walked me through the law library. And I walked through the law library and I look, and everybody my age is sitting at a desk with books piled up to the ceiling. And I just, by the time I got to the elevator, I went, oh, I can't do this. Went right back, and Dean Smith hired me as an assistant coach. And then about 2 months later, Frank McGuire called up Dean and said, hey, I lost my assistant. Do you mind if I can talk to Donnie? And I ended up with him down in South Carolina as a coach. I just knew I can't do this, you know. And it was two things. It was, that's not the way I saw myself, sitting there reading books all day. And the second thing was, I really couldn't give up basketball. I didn't want to give it up, you know, and that really probably drove me for the next, till today. You know?
Did you still ever play the what-if game? If I went with his law firm and Nixon, and if we, you know, the guys in the law firm went to the White House, and I would have ended up there, and how different?
Did
you ever play that
what-if? Yeah, and I've talked about that, because when I was in my last year of law school, I interviewed with Nixon's law firm, and also with the Justice Department Honors Program Criminal Division. So when I look back, I thought, well, I would have been in it, depending on the job I took, one way or the other.
You would have been in the middle of it.
Yeah.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
What does this Thanksgiving mean to you?
Well, it means a lot more than any Thanksgiving I can remember, because by all rights, I shouldn't be here. The nurses and the doctors said, you know, you were right up to the limit. In fact, you probably were over the limit. You were right there. The nurse said, boy, you pushed this one right to the edge.
The MMQB Podcast with Peter King. Subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Movement Watches was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. The watchmaker's goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at revolutionary prices. With over 500,000 watches sold to customers in 160-plus countries around the world, Movement Watches has solidified itself as the world's fastest-growing watch company. Movement Watches start at just $95. At a department store, you're looking at $400 to $500. Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and the retail markup, providing the best possible price. Movement offers classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism, and they've sold over 500,000 watches in over 160 countries. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movementwatches.com. That's MVMTwatches.com/Woj, W-O-J. MV as in Victor, MT, watches.com/Woj. So now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to movementwatches.com/Woj and join the movement. Now back to Donnie Walsh.
You grew up in New York, and you went to Fordham Prep.
Yes.
And you went to North Carolina to play for Frank McGuire.
Right.
And Frank left after your junior year.
Right.
And your senior year of college was Dean Smith's first
year. And
first
Dean was my freshman coach, so he came the same year I came.
What separated Dean from everybody else?
You know, I'll tell you a story, then I'll tell you. When I got to North Carolina, he was a freshman coach. So he took myself and my roommate and brought us all to this old gym that they had. It wasn't, you know, they're all old gyms now, but back then there was another gym that was a new gym, and this was the old gym. And it was called the Tin Can, and we'd go in there, and Dean started basically coaching us in defense. And I remember walking out of there after about a week going like, I've never heard the stuff this guy's telling us to do at all. And it was great stuff now. But that was my first idea. Like, I've never heard anybody talk about defense like this. Because he's got real different ideas on what you do defensively. Now they're pretty generally used. But in those days, I never heard anybody talk about this. And then as it developed, he had basically four or five defenses. And he has two numbers system where he'll call out 24, all right? Well, the first number is where you pick him up on the court. Two would be half court. Mm-hmm. Three would be three-quarter court. Four would be full court. And one would be you're in a collapsing man-to-man type defense or a zone, something like that. So, I mean, it's so well thought out. And see, I played 3 years for Frank McGuire, who basically believed in freelance basketball. And the way he taught it was, you come in, you went through drills and all mm-hmm. that, you might have done some dummy offense, and then you scrimmage. Mm-hmm. Now, people will say, oh, he just rolled the ball out. No, he didn't. Because when you scrimmage, if you did the wrong thing or what he didn't want you to do, he would stop practice a lot. And, you know, no, I don't want you to do this. And by the time he finished, you were playing like one man. I mean, five guys could play like one. Dean did it another way. His practices were timed to the second, and he went over everything and broke it down and had drills for everything. And so what I learned right away was there's no one way to do this because these guys, both of them in the Hall of Fame. Both of them were great coaches. Both of them won national championships. So, you know, that was a valuable lesson for me, which I think about when I became a pro general manager, that, you know, you got to give the guidance as to what you want to do mm-hmm. by the way you build the team. But then you got to have a coach who's got enough breadth that he can adjust to different things.
Dean had some chances. He had plenty of chances to go to the NBA. I'm sure he called for your counsel on different situations. What do you think of this? Did you ever feel he came close to doing it?
No. Dean, to me, when I think back on him, and he was still living at the time that I started thinking about this, he was the perfect college coach. He was like a Mr. Chips, you know what I mean, of college basketball. He was a wonderful guy. He was really comfortable in teaching college guys how to play. I think he loved the college game. He loved the competitiveness. Mm-hmm. And the ever-changing nature of it. I don't think he would enjoy going and having an owner buy all the players and then he wins. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, that's the way he would think of it. So I don't think he ever even thought of it, as far as I know.
Really sort of the father of the modern college program. The idea of a program and bringing players back and keeping them a part of it. What's always remarkable to me, and I'll be around Carolina grads, players who are in front offices, coaching in the league, and we were in Portsmouth a couple years ago at the pre-draft camp, and we were in a restaurant after the game. I think I was sitting with Maktar Injai, who played at Carolina. He's now an agent at Wasserman. And Mitch Kupchak came in. And Maktar jumped to his feet and shook Mitch's hand.
Right.
And he said, now, Mitch hasn't played at Carolina for 30, 40, I don't know how many years, right. And Maktar has been. And he said, but that's what Dean Smith taught his guys. When you see an ex-Carolina player, you stand up, you shake his hand, and you'd see it in, I remember Michael Corrin one day, were on a Nets practice years and years ago, and I think Dean had left and retired, and they had lost a bad game to somebody. And I sort of kidded with Mike. I said, hey, how do you think Dean couldn't have liked that? And he said to me, it's Coach Smith.
Right.
And he was half joking, but not, but just the way guys carried it on, I don't know if anybody had ever seen that before.
Well, he was that kind of a guy. I mean, he really thought as much of the last guy on the team as the first guy. And now, you know, when he's coaching the team, he knew who was who. But the minute practice stopped and, you got out into the real world, or he was brought you in to talk about academics, he spent as much time and cared about the last guy on the team as he did the first guy on the team. And that's true. I know a lot of guys say that, but they don't do it.
Absolutely.
He was a wonderful guy.
And in the context of these times and what's going on in this country now, the courage he took, and you saw it firsthand, you saw segregated ACC. You saw an ACC where Charlie Scott came in and Coach Smith brought him in. There were the pressures of the job and winning. It was North Carolina. You had to win. But the pressure that he took on himself to do what he felt socially was the right thing, and which was not popular with a lot of people in the South.
No, that's true. But the thing about Dean, because I lived there when he was doing some of those things, he didn't do those things loudly. He just did them all the time. And so you got to know it. And then at some point, somebody would pick up on it and get a quote from him. But he wasn't like showing, you know what I mean? He just did them. And if you asked him, he'd give you an answer why he did them. But other than that, it was so personal to him, everything he did do, that he wasn't doing it to make a big splash one way or the other. I think he was sincere in believing what he believed, and he would stand behind it. And he ran his life that way. So that's what I mean. He was an unusual guy. And I really don't think he would have enjoyed being a pro coach. And I know he loved being a coach in college. I know that. But he's a competitor now. Let me tell you, once the game starts, all bets are off.
Right.
And see, I went down to South Carolina, and we had come back and compete with him with Frank McGuire, who was his boy, who brought him into the ACC. And we wanted to win, and he wanted to win. And, you know, even though, you know, we always kept our friendships, it was a little tough in those days. You know, if we won or they won, it was hard.
And you know this, Donnie, the pro life is different. Like, you are the idea of molding young guys, and you hope you can make an impact on people. But, again, we talk, it's transactional in nature. Like, you're going to be judged on winning.
Yeah.
But I wonder this year, Meta World Peace, who I'm mad you still call Ron.
Right.
Meta came back with the Lakers and sought you out, bumped into you, and talked to you about, and he came out and talked publicly about it, about the impact you had on his life. He went through some tumultuous times in Indiana. You went through a lot with him. You spent a lot of, there were a lot of crises and a lot of.
There were, yeah.
And the fact that I would imagine coming from your dean and programs that had to feel pretty good to have him come back and say, you impacted.
It did feel good. Because I do try to do that, you know, as, you know, we're in an employer-employee relationship, so to speak. But that didn't ever said to me that I didn't develop a relationship with the players. Mm-hmm. And I always tried to do that. And in Ronnie's case, you know, obviously he was doing little things that I'd say, God, Ronnie, you know, we talk about it. And then when he really had a problem, actually we had, which he's talked about, or I wouldn't talk about it. He had seen psychologist, I think it was, for a while before that happened. And actually when he went over to the table and laid down, do you remember that in that fight?
Yep.
The psychologist said, look, if you feel yourself getting angry, just get away and just calm yourself. So he went down and laid on the table. And everyone acted like that was a provocative thing.
Right.
But he really was trying to do the right thing.
And then the cup came down.
Yeah, and the cup hit him in the head, and that was it.
You both grew up in New York. You grew up at different times in New York, but you grew up with New York, and that connection, was that always an asset for you, that you were both New York guys, and when he would talk to you, or when you would talk to him, that gave you some credibility with him at the time?
I think the fact that I grew up and played there, you know, if he talked about, you know, I'm backing down from anybody. I understood it, mm-hmm. you know, in a different way, and he knew I did. Mm-hmm. It was little things like that, that as you go on in life, you realize the same things happen in Indiana with a different accent. You know, it's the same thing.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by digital media. Find your voice.
And now a word from Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century, fast, powerful, and completely online. Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork? With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you to get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored for your unique financial situation. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/Woj. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Donnie, the decision you made to go to the Knicks and the opportunity there to go back home and take a team or an organization that was down, what do you remember your agent, still your agent, Steve Kaufman, at the time when the Knicks reach out and say, we'd like to find a way to make this work? What was your initial thought? Had you always dreamed about it? Had you just thought, I'll always work here? When the opportunity first came, how much thought did you have to give it?
That's a great question, because the answer doesn't come out in like historical terms. You know, I had hired Larry to be the general manager. I was the president of the whole franchise thing. I mean, I was business and basketball. And I was getting tired, because if you've got both of them, you're going the whole time. Mm-hmm. There's no off season. And so I, in my own mind, had, I think Larry's here 4 or 5 years. And so I kept thinking to myself, I got to let this guy take over. And I was getting tired, so I decided, well, I'm going to retire. I'd actually had a press conference saying that. And then sometime after that, this New York thing came at me. So at first I'm thinking, no, I don't know if I can do that. And then I started thinking about it. Well, wait a minute. I could go back home. I would love to try to fix the Knicks, you know, make them better. Maybe that would be my last challenge. And so pretty quickly, once I started thinking that way, then I went up and met them, and they made the offer. And next thing I know, I was up there. But I hadn't thought about it before that time. It wasn't like I left Indy to go there, you know, and I really didn't. I was going to leave my job and just retire. Now, the fact I got the New York job, that helped me retire later on, which I still haven't done, but it will.
Before we talk about the Knicks, you had just gotten to New York. You had smoked most of your adult life, all your adult life.
Right.
And one day, you're living in a hotel room. I think your family was still back in Indiana. You were sort of like, you've moved and you're going to sort of live in both places a little bit, and your family. You're in your hotel room one day in New York, and you're looking in the mirror, and what happens?
Well, I had come back to Indiana to be with my wife for a while, but then I had to go to my first press conference in New York. So I went to the dentist, and the dentist said, you've got a spot on your tongue. You ought to have it checked by an oral surgeon. And I said, oh, okay. So he gave me the name, and I went right over there because I was leaving the next day to go to New York. So I go right over, and a guy says, look, it could be anywhere from plaquia to cancer. You know, I should take a biopsy, and then I can let you know. And I was leaving to go to a press conference, so I said, well, I can't do it right now because I got to talk tomorrow, and I don't want my tongue to be all swollen up or something. And so I went back to New York. So now I'm back there, and I'm not dealing with it, you know, because I was there in April, I think. Mm-hmm. And my wife is bugging me, and, you know, my sister's bugging me. And so finally I go and get a biopsy in New York, and it comes back. It's cancer. So when you're talking about is when I got that information. And I remember going to the hotel and looking in the mirror and going, you are really a fool. You had your lungs checked. You had everything checked, you know, to see if there was cancer. But the one place where you put the thing was in your mouth. And, you know, in New York at that time, they had these ads come on all the time. And they were horrible ads that relate directly to oral cancer. So I'm sitting there and I'm going, well, I tell you what, if the guy has to cut my tongue off, I'm going to leave directly that night and go back to my house in Indiana, go in the backyard, and I'm never coming out. I mean, I was really shook about that. But I was fortunate that I got a great surgeon. I mean, he was reputed to be the number one guy in the world. And he took it out. He said to me the first time I met him, he said, well, the answer to your problem is surgery and only surgery. And I've done it many times. He was an Indian gentleman. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, and I can get it out. He said, but you know what the real answer to your problem is. And I said, I got to stop smoking, right, Doc? And he said, that's right. And he gave me the percentages. If you stop smoking, there's small, like 3% chance it could come back. If you don't, it'll be over 50 that it'll come back. I stopped then, right there. And it was the best thing I ever did. And it didn't, I thought it would really be hard to do that, but it wasn't. It surprised me.
The challenge in New York, Donnie, everything was, you were geared toward 2010. You came in 08,
right,
and it was geared toward free agency in 2010. LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, and then the others, Joe Johnson, Amari Stoudemire, but the big three were the big three. And
right,
you had never built that way. You hadn't. You had done it through the draft in Indiana all those years, and you'd supplement here and there trades and players, but your core, and you drafted well. You created the assets, drafted Danilo Gallinari in New York, and started to create some assets that you'd be able to use, but it was such an all-or-nothing proposition. Were you comfortable with it? Did you just say, hey, this is the way we have to go? But it was it's a tough way to do that, to go into free agency, to go all or nothing. We're going after LeBron. We're going after Wade. We're going after Bosh.
Well, I knew pretty quickly that we weren't going to get LeBron. I think I did. You know, I can tell you I did.
Why? Why did you think that?
Just, I thought this, when I hear him talk, I felt that he had a definite idea of what he wanted to do. And the one thing I think that the players in the league, particularly of that stature, really know what they want to do. In other words, they're smart guys. They know, the bottom line is you're not going to talk them into not doing it. You know what I mean? So my feeling was that he had already made up his mind. Now I went up and met with him and all, and just the way that went, I didn't think we'd get him. But, you know, I still would go after the next one, which was Amari, who had come into New York and said he wanted to be there.
Right.
And so I said, okay, I want to hear a guy wants to be here, you know? Because honestly, back then, I really thought, I couldn't see any reason why great players wouldn't want to play in New York. You know, it's like the seat of everything. And I think if, let's say, LeBron or Carmelo comes to New York, they're like an icon like Babe Ruth right away, you know, and so they're going to get a lot of opportunities and that kind of thing. So I thought it'd be very attractive. But I saw with LeBron, and then I saw what happened after that, that these kids today that are that good, they know that no matter where they go, they're going to get the same marketing opportunities because it's going to follow them.
Yeah.
They're going to be in the same position whether in New York or anywhere else. And I didn't really feel that when I went into that. I would feel it now. And it's just a matter of how you deal with it. You know, some guys want to be in a city like that. Some guys don't.
And I think, too, and you market became, there was a time in the NBA, if you wanted to be on television, you played in New York, Boston, Chicago, L.A. Those were the teams on Philadelphia at times. Those were the teams on TV. Well, that had all changed. Every game's on everywhere.
Right.
Every night. You can get a massive shoe deal in Cleveland, Oklahoma City.
That's exactly right.
The built-in advantages of New York and L.A., it's not enough just to have great geography anymore.
Right. It's not. And even though the city is great, New York City's great, got great fans, all that, pretty much these guys are going to win where they go. And they feel like, well, I'll just create that wherever I go. And pretty much they did it.
You saw this coming. It's hard. You can't go to your fans and say, hey, guys, I don't think we're getting him. You can't say it. You got to go through the process. But there was an expectation and a buildup of, hey, the Knicks are going to be players in this, and they need to be. And
yeah, that's something I would challenge right away now. You know, I didn't do it back then, but What makes you think that if this kid don't want to come here, we can get him? And you're acting like you've got to do something. Well, tell me what, right? You're offering him the most money you can offer him. You're giving him the keys to the city. Now, what else can you do?
You had hired a coach of Mike D'Antoni who you felt was a coach who had a system that would appeal to great players.
And a personality.
Right.
He was a great guy and a great guy to play for. So, yeah, that's one of the reasons I chose Mike. I had watched him for a while, and I knew his style was different, but I knew that he knew what he was doing. And if I have any regret in New York, it's that I didn't get good players for him. You know, we were on our way, but at the end of the third year, you know, we had a couple of really good players, but then we didn't have time to go out and get the... See, my belief is I don't care how many stars you get, you got to create a team.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a team, it won't make any difference. So you have stars. You'll do a little better, but you're not going to really be a force in the league. It's got to be a really good team.
Looking back, so in your mind, if you could go back to 09 leading into summer of 2010, you would have started to prepare people a little bit. Hey, this, we may not get these guys. You would have maybe nuanced it more with New York looking back.
I think you're right. I mean, I would have been smarter to do that.
Yeah.
You know, because I know what I felt, but I wasn't going to get up publicly and say this because when you're in that kind of position, you're selling season tickets at the same time. So, you know, you don't want to blow the poor marketing guy's game either. You know, if you don't think you're going to get him. And I did think we'd get some people, so I knew we'd have better players. And that was proven because the next year they went and made the playoffs.
Right.
And so, you know, that was a first for New York in I don't know how many years, and a first at a winning season. We actually had a winning season that year. And then I left, which, you know, when I look back on it, if I stayed another year and couldn't got more players, you know, to come and play with these guys, that's the key. You get the stars, and then you get guys that fit with them. And it isn't going to happen overnight. You know, it just isn't. And, you know, I agree with you. I think a lot of people think, oh, you get the players, you're going to win right away. Well, no, you're not. You know, LeBron did going back to Cleveland. And once they got the team out in Golden State, but they had to have a team. You know, Stephen Curry didn't just walk in and they won. Right. I mean, it took time to get the players and to fit them in and to get a coach that had a style that they could play it with.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
Hi, boys and girls. It's Tony Kornheiser reminding you to subscribe and listen to my daily podcast where we talk about everything from sports to politics to the impending animal revolution. And remember, you can listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play.
Buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a very confusing process for a long time. It's always been hard to find the best deal for that game or show you want to go to, but SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and never miss a deal. You could even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know if the ticket prices fall. And even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat, which is a personal favorite of mine because every arena is different. Every stadium is different. It's perfect. That's why I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone, and I use it often because it's simple and it works. And best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. They show you the full ticket price from start to finish and never try to trick you with big fees on the checkout page. Now listen closely to this next part because it's real important. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. That's right, $20 right into your pocket. And all you've got to do is this. Download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code, then enter promo code WOJ. SeatGeek will then send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. It does not get any easier than that. So please support SeatGeek the way they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code WOJ today. Now back to Donnie Walsh. Jim Dolan was a different kind of owner. It was different than the Simons. When the Carmelo trade came, And there became a point where, and I remember it was All-Star Weekend. I believe it was All-Star Weekend.
It was.
Where Jim went into a meeting with Masai Ujiri in Denver and I think Leon Rose and his agent. And Jim took over the talks and
right.
started to give more than you. I remember, let's see, it was a weekend. Trade deadline was Wednesday. And, you know, it's a dance right up until that trade deadline of leverage. And I don't want to put Mozgov in the deal. I don't want to give you another pick. And he went in and he basically gave up what you hadn't wanted to.
But he did call me. In other words, he called me at a certain point. He was out there and I was reading about it and all that. And he said, well, here's what it's going to take. And I don't think you're going to get it done if you don't do this. And it was the deal kind of that got done. And he said, might have been the same or another phone call. He said, look, Donnie, I'm not a basketball guy. I can't make this decision. So this is your decision. And I said, okay. I said, I want to call up Mike D'Antoni. Mike didn't really want to do it either. And I thought, we're never going to get a guy like Carmelo Anthony if we don't do this deal. And so I'm going to do it. And I made up my mind. I kind of knew I'd have to give up Gallinari, who I loved, and Wilson Chandler, who I loved too. I thought any deal that we were going to do to get Carmelo, that was going to happen. But I didn't like giving up Mozgov. I didn't like giving up the little point guard.
Raymond Felton,
because I didn't see the reason for that, why they would want him. You know, they had point guards out there at the time. And as it worked out, they didn't want him, you know. And they couldn't trade him because he didn't play there or something. And so I justify it by saying exactly that. That if you want to get a player of that nature, and Amari, and I would defend him with the Knicks later, you know, as he got older, I think his knees went. But he never had knee problems when I was around him.
Right.
And he worked very hard not to have them. But I think that you've got to keep things stable to a degree. And we didn't do that. I mean, I left. Mike left after a while. Glenn came in, he left. You know, when you give the reins to a team, to a general manager, he's going to, like, start to build it. If every 3 years you change that, each guy's coming in to build his own team again. So it's like this all the time. And I think that's what hurt up in New York.
And you said, like, hey, Dolan called you and said, well, here's what I'm going to do or here's what I'm proposing to do. But you've lost. Once he goes in the room and the other GM knows he's got the owner who doesn't know basketball like you do, you've lost your leverage. Now at this point, you're not dealing from a position of strength anymore as a GM. And at this point, because I think part of you said, I know Carmelo wants to be here. And if he goes into free agency,
well, here's one thing that did get my attention and probably tipped it to where, you know, I wasn't going to hold out, particularly when I'm being told this is a deal. Mm-hmm. And that was that if you don't do it, he's going to Brooklyn.
Right.
And that bothered me, you know, for a lot of reasons. You know, because Carmelo he's the kind of guy that could tip the scales very easily. And I wanted him. I thought he was a terrific offensive player. And I thought and this may not have worked out, but I told him this, that I didn't see anything he couldn't do in basketball. In other words, I know he can score. I know he can shoot, but I knew he could rebound. I also told him, I've watched you defensively. I watched you play LeBron. And I could see in LeBron's eyes, he wasn't quite sure of you. And I said, and I know he can pass. So there's nothing you can't do. And I think that you should, at that time, I thought he was a little heavy. I said, I think you should lose weight. Mm-hmm. And I think you should concentrate on being that kind of player because you can already do these things. And, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of coaches have tried to get him to do that, and he does it at times.
You went through that scenario, the trade scenario with Carmelo. There's a point in which Jim Dolan wants to bring back Isaiah Thomas back into the organization to work, which did not seem like an ideal situation for you to have him back in the front office. Did those things start to weigh on you that there's enough pressure to do the job? There's enough pressure, even when everyone's pulling in the same direction and you're connected, it's really hard to win in the league. But when you're starting to fight these other fights about how much control I have, or if I'm trying to put a plan in place, we can't veer off. There's a reason that it just became, it's not worth the angst of fighting these battles with him anymore. And I'm ready to go.
Well, it wasn't like I got sick and tired of Jim. All right. Because I knew Jim when I went there. And so I knew what it was going to be like. I knew what the press in New York was like. I knew that it was a much harder job for a lot of those reasons than being in Indiana or another franchise in the league. But what happened was I just got to the point where I thought, and the thing about Isaiah, you know, I really liked Isaiah, and I know it's crazy to say that because it doesn't look that way, but I did. I really liked him.
You hired him as your coach in Indiana?
Yeah. I just didn't think, and I told him this, I don't think you should stay in New York. This is too hard. Your family can't even go out in the public. So, and I knew I couldn't get the attention on the team as long as he was connected with it. So that's why I advised us to let him go. And I felt bad about it. But then when you're bringing him back, I wouldn't have cared so much. But, you know, what is he going to do now? I mean, do you still want me here? Or, you know, just tell me because I'll go. And I never could read that. And then I think Jim, as it went on, realized that New York at that time, anyhow, wasn't going to accept that. Isaiah, mm-hmm. not over me or anything else, but just him back again. It would have been just the headlines all
right.
the time.
It would have been every single day. It could never be about anything else.
Right. And right. When you're trying to build a team, you want to focus on that, and you want the players to feel that. And so, you know, I probably wasn't in conjunction with that. And, you know, I don't know what that meant, but I wasn't. I feel bad. I still feel bad because I liked Isaiah. But I really felt like if you do this, this is going to become a circus, really, is what I thought. I might have been wrong, but that's what I thought.
You were wrong on that one. You said something, I think you said it to me once in just a conversation about legacy. And people, I think you'd leave New York and people would say, what was your legacy in New York? And you have an interesting perspective on what legacy is in life, which is...
It's your children. It's your family. It's not...
Do your kids still call you? That's your legacy, right? Do your kids still call you?
Exactly. Right? It's your family. It's not got anything to do with basketball. Look, I went into basketball... I worked it for my entire life. I did the best I could. I got paid for it. When it's over with, it's in the public record. Whatever you want to think about it, I did, you can do it. But legacy, I mean, I'm not worried about that. I'm not. And it probably will, you know, get changed around 10 times. So,
well, I mean, you look back, though, and winning. Listen, Michael Jordan got in your way. Sometimes it's, you know this, in history, it's timing. And when you came along, and you came along with Michael in his prime here, and
we brought it down to the last game with those guys. Yeah, we did it with Shaq and Kobe. That was the finals.
Right.
We did it with Michael, Patrick Ewing, and those guys. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was a good team. And Pat Riley. It was mainly those guys.
Right.
Yeah, we ran into one of them at the end, and they were too good for us. You know, they just outdid us. So there was no way to deny it. And Chicago at that time, it wasn't just Michael, mm-hmm. although Michael was so good. But then there was Pippen and, you know, other guys that came, Grant, mm-hmm. you know, guys like that that people forget. They had a good team.
And when teams stayed together for as long as they did, you had long runs against the Bulls, long runs against the Knicks, where now the teams change and the team you're preparing to beat this year all of a sudden changes and now you're looking – you know, a few years ago, you were looking at Miami.
Right.
How do we get through Miami with Hibbert and Paul George and David West? But then I would imagine you go to bed thinking about that Bulls team. You wake up thinking about that Bulls team. And you're making marginal, like, we can just get a little better here, a little better here. You probably didn't think of anything more than you thought of. Where's an edge I can get on them?
That is exactly right, is that when you're – the general manager or the president of basketball, whatever you want to call yourself, that's all you think about. And it doesn't, it's not just during the season, it's all summer. And it's how am I going to overcome Michael Jordan? How are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? How are we going to get as good as they are? Because they're the teams that keep beating us. And I thought I had it a couple of times. I really did.
Larry Brown, your history with Larry was, you know, you had worked under him. You knew Larry better than anyone. I think you had the great line on Larry, right? Larry's only happy when he's miserable.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
For Detroit, you know, Detroit, Joe Dumars brought in Larry. He put him over the top and they won and you brought in Larry and you got right there. You got right to the cusp of it.
Right away, too.
Right away.
In his first year. Now, you got to understand, we were going to the first round of the playoffs, getting beat pretty regularly back then. We were in the playoffs, but we get beat in the first round. Larry comes in. He starts out, I think somebody told me the other day, 1-6. And then he goes and wins 48 games, and we get to the Eastern Conference Finals. So we went from not making the second round all the way up to Eastern Conference Finals. Then he did it the second year. Then all of a sudden, the Larry started coming into it. He was, I knew, oh, he's getting squirrely on me now.
Right, which is like, you have a bad night. He comes in the morning. Yeah. He wants to trade five guys, right?
Yeah.
And then.
But I never had any problem with that because of our relationship.
Right. You knew it was coming, and you knew how to handle it.
I mean, he would come in every day. I don't know if I can say it the way I would say it.
Sure you can.
You know, he would come in and say, I want to trade X. And I'd go, I'm not trading X, Larry. Get the fuck out of here. And he'd go, well, you know me. I'm crazy. Yeah. I'd say, yeah, I do. And then he'd say, let's go to lunch. I said, okay. And he would never get mad. I would never get mad.
Since you came back to Indiana and now the advisory role, Donnie, has the phone rang? Has somebody else, if you've got any feelers, hey, Donnie, you want to come back and run my team? Do you, those calls still come or
no,
do people think you're retired?
Yeah, I think they either think I'm too old or I'm retired. I don't know. And I would agree with them both ways. I'm not retired because I go in every day. But I don't feel like I'm doing what I did before. You know, mm-hmm. I feel it's a little more casual than that. And I hope I'm having an impact. Now this, I told, Herbie may read this, so I got to be careful there. But I told somebody, you know, I need Herbie to come in here and say, you got to get out of here. We're not going to take you back next year. Because every year I keep thinking, I don't know if I should go back. I'm getting too old to do this and all that. But I always come back. And I said, so I need somebody to tell me, no, you can't come back.
Well, it's not happening in the league. And I think, and you're a testament to this, Donnie, that people put a premium on a lot of things in basketball and team building, whether it's analytics and lots of different things that all have a role in it. But you said it earlier, like sitting down and talking to people face to face on deals. It's become a texting league, an emailing league. People don't always sit and talk anymore. And the relationships you built through the league, they stand the test of time, and it's how you do business. And I know they appreciate that in Indiana, and you talk to other GMs in the league, and they've always got that from you, that we're all in this hopefully for the long run, and that, you know, to try to get over on somebody or to cut.
No, I see.
I
never believe
we're all going to be back at the same table again.
Exactly.
And I do think that's lost in the league now.
Yeah, it
it's
be.
A little more.
I'm not on the phones now, so I don't know that. But I got to get that impression. Kevin Pritchard's one guy that I know. He goes all around the league, and he does have relationships with guys. So I think that's being done. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad we have a guy that's doing it, because I think whenever I've had to really trade a guy where it was like, got to trade him, I would start calling up immediately. And I wouldn't stop for a whole year until I got him traded. And people say, there's no way you're going to be able to trade this guy. And I said, no, something's going to happen. You'll see what I mean. And all of a sudden, boom, somebody call up and say, hey, my owner wants that player. Okay, we'll do the deal. And I think you get that feeling that you're not going to talk anybody into anything in the league. But there's going to be somebody, if the guys are good, that they'll say, I think we can handle that guy, you know, that kind of thing. And so I always did it that way. I see Kevin kind of the same way in the sense that he's always on the phone, or he's going up with the team and meeting GMs there and going to dinner with them. And I think that's what the job is. You're dealing with 29 other guys. There's no reason why you can't get to know them well enough, you know, that you get a feel for what they want and what you want. And maybe you decide both, well, you don't have what I want, I don't have what you want. But at least you know that. So, you know, you don't drive each other crazy on the phone every 2 days.
How many deals, Donnie, do you think back, and probably especially the Pacer years, where you go, man, I was close to doing that trade.
Oh,
Thank God I didn't. Too many to remember?
A lot.
The luck in this of, like, a deal that you would have done that, looking back, would have been a disaster, and thank goodness the other guy pulled out of it.
Yeah,
right?
No,
like,
there's a lot of deals like that.
Right.
Really a lot of deals.
Because it's always easier in hindsight to look back and say that. At the time, like,
you know, it's funny, in New York, I got in deals where we committed to the deal, but then there's an illness or or injury provision, you get a chance to physical.
Yeah.
And I'd come back bad. But it was in the years that I knew he's up next year, so I'm still going to do this deal.
Right.
But that was hard because I knew I'm going to look like an asshole here. I really am. You know, those were things that when I did them, I was like, I hope them. Dolan and actually Stern understand what I'm doing here. And they did, so it wasn't that big a deal. But at the time, those are really hard when you're sitting in your house and you're, am I really going to do a deal for a guy I know can't play?
Oh, man. Donnie, this is fantastic. I appreciate you taking the time on a Sunday in Indianapolis.
And you are like the Bible or something. When you ever print something, it's going to happen. So
I appreciate that, Donnie. Thanks for doing this.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. A big thank you today to NBA legend Donnie Walsh. Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to the podcast. And be sure to subscribe to the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. You can find us on thevertical.com, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play. And you can hear us on the Vertical Podcast Network every weekday at 3 p.m. Eastern, on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsors today, SeatGeek and Movement Watches. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll catch you next time.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.